The period from November 14th to November 21st has seen the greatest flare-up of violence in the Middle East region since Operation Cast Lead in 2008-2009. Much of the Western media, and certainly Western political leaders, portray Operation Pillar of Cloud as a counter-terrorism operation against Hamas terrorists. Is this the whole story? On today's program, Allison Deeger of Mondo Weiss will give us the perspective from the West Bank and whether the recent ceasefire agreement will last. And later, Stephen Lentman joins us for a second week in a row to put the conflict in a wider geopolitical context. On today's show, Target, Gaza. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 22nd, 2012. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. But first, here are the news headlines for the week of November 22nd, 2012. An Egyptian-brokered ceasefire between Hamas and Israel followed 8 days of elevated violence and took effect at 9 p.m. local time amid a cloud of distrust on both sides. Even as the ceasefire went into effect, about a dozen rockets fell into Israeli territory. In addition, an explosion is reported to have occurred in Gaza, although the cause is unclear. The ceasefire seems to have staved off, for the time being, a ground invasion of Gaza by Israeli defense forces. But trust is in short supply. Khaled Mashal, the exiled leader of Hamas, pledged to respect the truce as long as Israel did, but would respond to violations. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who faces a parliamentary election in January, said he would likewise honor the truce, but held open the door to resuming the conflict. In addition to calling for a cease to all hostilities, the deal also called on Israel to relax its restrictions on Gaza residents. According to Hamas, the deal allows for the opening of all the border crossings which Israel controls. Israel, however, says they did not agree to lift its economic blockade of Gaza, which has been in effect since 2006. 5 Israelis and 162 Gazans, including 37 children, have died in the 8-day conflict. And that comes to us from Reuters. According to a study by University of Minnesota scientists, the annual flu jab is not as effective at preventing illness as proponents claim, that the benefits of the shot are overhyped, and that these vaccinations are essentially a waste of money. The team of scientists relied on studies measuring the effectiveness of the flu jab, which went back to the 1930s. Professor Michael Osterholm, one of the researchers, said, quote, "I have been a strong proponent of vaccination in general, and flu vaccine in particular, for many years. I still recommend its use as the best we have, but we have overpromoted this vaccine. That has had a very dampening effect on the development of new vaccines," unquote. A spokesperson for the Department of Health in the UK countered by saying, quote, "There is no doubt that the flu program saves lives. Evidence on the effectiveness of the vaccine is reviewed by the Joint Committee of Vaccination and Immunization, and this year the committee undertook a detailed review of the flu vaccine program. Each year, thousands of people die after catching flu, and we urge everyone that is in an at-risk group to get the vaccine." And that comes to us from the Daily Mail. On Tuesday, November 20th, the Congolese rebel group M23, believed to be backed by Rwanda, successfully took over the eastern Congolese frontier city of Goma. The takeover followed days of clashes between M23 and the UN-backed Congolese army. The rebels then went on to capture the nearby town of Sake on Wednesday and has their sights set on the strategic eastern town of Bukavu. The violence has displaced over 100,000 people, half of whom are children, according to the UN Children's Agency. Rwanda and Uganda are believed to be responsible for backing the rebels and equipping them with sophisticated equipment, including night vision goggles and 120-millimeter mortars. A report released Wednesday from the UN group of experts stated Rwanda and Uganda had, quote, cooperated to support the creation and expansion of the political branch of M23 and have consistently advocated on behalf of the rebels, unquote. According to UN experts, Rwanda has intervened repeatedly in the Democratic Republic of Congo over the last 18 years. Congo is an underdeveloped country rich in coveted mineral wealth, including gold, copper, and coltan, which is used in mobile phones. Both Rwanda and Uganda deny backing the rebels and have not as yet faced international condemnation. And that comes to us from the Associated Press and Reuters. On Thursday, November 22nd, after a three-week siege, a Syrian rebel group has captured a key military base with artillery stockpiles in the strategic province of Deir el-Zour. The base, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, was the last stronghold for the Syrian regime's forces. Syrian TV reported early Thursday morning in the upscale neighborhood of Mazeh in Damascus that mortar shells struck during the rush hour, injuring at least one person. The neighborhood houses a number of foreign embassies, and on Tuesday, the information building was struck by two mortars. The Syrian conflict erupted in March 2011 following the Arab Spring uprisings and has morphed into a civil war and has seen increasing violence erupt in recent months with scores of car bombings and bombings determined to oust the Syrian leader. That comes to us from the Associated Press and Syrian TV. On Wednesday, November 21st, 2012, the following press statement was issued by Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh, and the translation is provided by journalist Julie Webb Pullman. Prime Minister, satisfied with this agreement, proud of the steadfastness of our people and their resistance, and thankful for Egypt's leading role. The Palestinian people have forged a new model in their steadfastness, patience, generosity, and creativity in the face of calamities and difficulties, and proved to be people of unbending resolve, able to achieve their will. Following the announcement of the ceasefire, we emphasize the following. 1. We mourn all the martyrs over the past 7 days of Israeli aggression and treachery, and call on the Almighty to ensure a speedy recovery for all the wounded. 2. We salute the heroic Palestinian people who expressed legendary steadfastness in the face of the Israeli war machine and aggression. 3. We express our deep appreciation for the heroic Palestinian resistance and exchanges which showed substantial strength in defense of the Palestinian people. 4. We appreciate the great vigil of the masses of the Palestinian people in the occupied West Bank and elsewhere to stand alongside their brothers and their people in the Gaza Strip, and defying the occupation's expectations and embodying the unity of our people, rallying around the aim of steadfastness and resistance. 5. We express our deep appreciation to the Arab Republic of Egypt and the great role played by President Mohamed Morsi and his government, and bless their efforts in order to reach this honorable termination of aggression against our people. 6. We appreciate the efforts made by the Arab League and all regional and international parties who stood by our people at this critical stage and who were quick to come to the Gaza Strip to express the position of solidarity in support of Palestinian resolve. 7. We congratulate our people on this victory that proved the Palestinian people's and the valiant resistance's high resilience, creativity, and composure, and showed the nation would stand by the people and that they are not alone, and we confirm that we are satisfied with this agreement. We provide for you now the full text of the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Gaza The verbatim English text of the ceasefire agreement between Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza, brokered by Egypt. The text was distributed by the Egyptian presidency. Agreement of understanding for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. 1. No title given for this section. A. Israel should stop all hostilities in the Gaza Strip land, sea and air, including incursions and targeting of individuals. B. All Palestinian factions shall stop all hostilities from the Gaza Strip against Israel, including rocket attacks and all attacks along the border. C. Opening the crossings and facilitating the movements of people and transfer of goods and refraining from restricting residents' free movements and targeting residents in border areas and procedures of implementation shall be dealt with after 24 hours from the start of the ceasefire. D. Other matters, as may be requested, shall be addressed. 2. Implementation mechanisms. A. Setting up the 0 hour for the ceasefire understanding to enter into effect. B. Egypt shall receive assurances from each party that the party commits to what was agreed upon. C. Each party shall commit itself not to perform any acts that would breach this understanding. In case of any observations, Egypt, as the sponsor of this understanding, shall be informed to follow up.
I'm speaking with Allison Deeger, who is a contributor and assistant editor to Mondo Weiss, and she is based right now in Ramallah, West Bank, and she has been there since before the recent spate of violence in Gaza, since early October, as a matter of fact, and so has been monitoring the situation quite extensively. So thank you for joining us, Allison Deeger.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, as we're speaking right now, a ceasefire has been announced, brokered by Egypt. And at least for the time being, there's been an end of hostilities. What do you make of that ceasefire? Is it likely to last?
At the moment, I am a bit skeptical that the ceasefire will halt. When we saw the last major military strike on Gaza in 2008 and 2009 with Operation Cast Lead, it took a few times for a ceasefire to hold. And so I think we need to wait a few days to see what will happen. As well, the Israeli military, within the first hour of the ceasefire being announced, made a statement that if rockets are fired from Gaza, they will resume airstrikes. So I will say both the Israeli government and Hamas are prepared in the event that a ceasefire should not hold.
How much of this ceasefire agreement is related to the perception of the conflict and the players involved in the eyes of the international community?
I think that being here on the ground, there's a big disconnect from Israelis and Palestinians that I've talked to versus what's happening in the international community. So while there was an uproar outside of the region about the amount of violence and things such as targeting of a media building in Gaza and the killing of journalists inside of the region, when speaking with Israelis on the street, there really was not any kind of a sense that external opinions were weighing in on whether or not to continue the military operation. It seems as though on the level of the international community pressure, that hits in at the Israeli government, but in terms of popular opinion, there really hasn't been a change.
So if there is a breach in the ceasefire, as you anticipate, are you seeing both Israel and Hamas prepared to blame the other side for the ending of the violence?
Well, I mean, I guess part of it depends on who strikes first. But in the context of rockets coming from Gaza, Gaza has been under a siege for the past few years, and though the siege was lessened about a year ago, there still is many, many restrictions on infrastructural redevelopment. And so that aspect is kind of a constant violence that is still imposed onto the Gaza Strip. And days ago, Hamas had articulated some of their demands, which included the lifting of the siege. And since that aspect has not happened, you know, it's hard to say if the ceasefire will hold. We're sort of at an impasse where the moment of rockets and bombs have stopped, but the ongoing violence that caused the initial airstrikes, that hasn't let up.
Now, there had been some anticipation, I mean, late last week, that it was looking like there was going to be a major ground invasion of Gaza by Israeli forces, and who knows, escalating it to who knows what. So this ceasefire was not. It does seem to be a change in what had been anticipating. So, do you sense that there was any kind of a miscalculation on the part of Israelis or Hamas in terms of why the way this process evolved from trying to win to trying to get some sort of arrive at a peace?
Well, when the Israeli government called in the reservists last week, the first call was for about 16,000 reservists, which is more than actually entered in the previous previous operation in 2008 and 2009. And then there was an additional call, which put the number at about 30,000. And my analysis is that call itself was part of an escalation of the conflict. Similarly, Abu Qassam Brigade released a video in Hebrew a few days ago with Arabic subtitles, threatening to resume suicide bombings inside of Israel, but we didn't see that happen as well. So I think that was also, that act itself was an escalation.
Okay, the calling of the reserves.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, there's been about 1,000 rockets fired by Hamas. There's been about over 1,000 military airstrikes into Gaza just the last 8 days. Do you what is the sense of who initiated this? Because it sounds like from you listen to most Western sources, they're saying they're blaming it on Hamas, and you look at other sources, they're blaming it on Israel. So what could you maybe help clarify that for us?
Sure. Well, I spoke with some aid workers who evacuated from Gaza last week on Thursday, and when they left, they had said that there were rockets from Gaza that had been fired for about 3 days before the Israelis targeted Ahmed al-Jabri, the second hayat in Hamas's military wing and the co-founder of Al-Qassam Brigade. But there is a distinction between the rockets that had been coming a few days before and the assassination of al-Jabri, because this is a region where there is kind of ongoing Israeli military assaults into Gaza, as well ongoing rockets coming out from time to time. The Israelis will bomb something like an open field, or a rocket will be launched and be intercepted by the Iron Dome, and this is actually the status quo. The status quo is not, you know, an absence of violence. The status quo is actually an ongoing violence, an ongoing military occupation. But the assassination of al-Jabri, this was really seen as an act of war because he was such an important person within the Hamas government. As well, the target that the Israeli government has selected have been buildings such as media compounds, and we're getting reports of different kinds of weapons that are used, some that release shrapnel, and then last night there was a lot of reports of heavy naval fire, and so it is very clear that the heavy the kind of the finite act of war from when this operation began came from Israeli fire, as well. It's very clear that most of the heavy shelling came from Israeli fire.
And most of the heavy casualties are on the Palestinian side, to be certain.
Yes, I think there's about 162 Palestinians that have been killed.
Now, you're based in Ramallah,
yes.
The West Bank. Could you maybe explain how this conflict has impacted your area?
Sure. Ramallah is generally considered, for those that live in the region, as the bubble. It's like the Tel Aviv of the West Bank, meaning that it's rare that there's demonstrations here. There's a cafe, nightlife. There's a lot of foreign donor aid money coming in, foreign investment money coming in, and so generally it's a calm city. But since Operation Pillar of Cloud has commenced, there have been demonstrations in Ramallah in the morning and in the evening, and then just 2 days ago, there's actually two different evening protests. As well, in the areas outside of Ramallah, there have been heavy clashes at the checkpoints. And this is very important to note, because these are areas that there have not been clashes at since the Second Intifada. So we are seeing across the West Bank in areas that generally did not have a lot of popular resistance, that resurgence of popular resistance. And this is very unexpected from both the Palestinian community and I would estimate as well the Israelis associates are quite surprised at the level of popular resistance. This did not happen in 2008 and 2009 during Operation Cast Lead. The response in the West Bank is markedly different.
And do you have any sense of how other Arab countries might be reacting to this?
In Jordan, for example, where there's been protests that have kind of started through the Arab Spring upswell. The past few days, they've taken a tenor of being protests for Palestine in opposition of Operation Pillar of Cloud. And then as well, there's been other demonstrations in Lebanon and in a few other parts of the region. But I think that Jordan is kind of an interesting example, because Amman is not a city where there's a lot of demonstrations and not a city where there's a lot of demonstrations in support of Palestine, and so that infusion of Palestine with what people are upset about with the monarchy is pretty noteworthy.
Now, you mentioned Arab Spring. There is also Egypt, which now has the a new government with a different relationship with Israel than had been the case previously. Is that a sort of a significant factor in all of this?
A lot of the same policies are in place from when Mubarak was still in power. What is different in the immediate is that a delegation of 400 Egyptians came into Gaza a few days ago. And that we hadn't seen before, and that likely would not have been possible in the past, same way that it was now. But it's also part of a general change of trends of what's happened in the past few days. There have been a number of foreign journalists that have also entered Gaza since Pillar of Cloud started. I think 3 days ago, a group of 40 Western journalists entered. And so it would not be entirely accurate to say that the delegation of Egyptians or outreach from Egyptians is indicative of the new government, but it just might be indicative of the nature of how things have functioned during this military operation.
Now, what about the United States? So what kind of an agent have they been through all of this? How have they acted to mitigate or escalate violence, as far as you can tell?
A few days ago, Obama spoke about Israel having a right to defend itself, and then Hillary Clinton was, of course, in the region today. Yesterday, she met with Benjamin Netanyahu. Today, she met with Mahmoud Abbas, and then she moved over to Egypt. But when she was in Ramallah for her meetings at the Palestinian Authority compound, the Mokata, she was met with protest from activists from Ramallah, other cities, and even American Jewish activists protested her in Ramallah. So I think that the sentiment from the street is that American officials are not welcome because they are seen so much as a military support to Israel that it compromises their position to be an unbiased party in brokering a ceasefire.
Now, I think one of the big surprises, at least as was recorded in the mainstream press, was the distance that the Gaza rockets were able to reach all the way up to Tel Aviv. Is there a sense that in that regard Israel may have miscalculated, and that's part of the reason why they seem to be changing course?
That was entirely unexpected. The Qassam Brigade, which has a very active Twitter account, and I recommend your listeners follow it for updates, as well as to see a good interaction between them and the IDF spokesperson. They had been saying for a few months now that their Grad rockets could reach Tel Aviv, although that was not widely believed because it hadn't been tested. But of course, we know now that yes, in fact, their rockets can reach Tel Aviv, and Israeli officials moved an Iron Dome anti-missile system to that district. And then within hours, a rocket was then fired over Tel Aviv and intercepted. So this is something very different, because prior to that, the rocket range, while still hitting in populated areas in southern Israel, could not hit, didn't have the ability to hit such a symbolic center to the state.
So with the that reality, and the fact is that this is happening during Israeli elections, so I'm wondering if you have any kind of a sense of how this is playing out among Israeli citizenry.
Haaretz, I believe Haaretz has reported that Netanyahu's poll numbers have increased since Operation Pillar of Cloud, and then Israeli Channel 10 News reported about 3 days ago that 91% of Israelis support the current military operation and 76% support a ground invasion. So we're seeing ostensibly across all political parties, except for, of course, Palestinian citizens of Israel and the Israeli left, support for Operation Pillar of Cloud and Netanyahu's defeated prime minister, support for him.
Well, Allison, we really appreciate those observations. Is there anything else you want the people in the outside world to know about as you're relaying this information from within that region?
Sure. I would just like to underscore the protests and clashes in the West Bank is really something that we haven't been seeing before. And they're at small roadblocks, main checkpoints, small checkpoints, Ofir prison, and journalists have been injured. There have been 4 Palestinians that have been killed in these clashes. And so there's a real sense of the West Bank experiencing the same kinds of violence that the people in Gaza are experiencing, of course, to different extents, but there is a certain degree of unification in the sentiments of the people on the ground. And then yesterday, I went to the funeral of Rashid Tamimi, who was the second person to be killed from Israeli fire in the protests against Gaza. And at his funeral, representatives from all the different Palestinian political parties spoke. So we are seeing something happening in the West Bank, and that's worth keeping an eye on even after the ceasefire.
Allison Dieger, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Great, thank you so much.
And I've been speaking with Allison Dieger, the assistant editor at Mondo Weiss, and she has been speaking to us from Ramallah.
I'm now speaking with the Chicago-based host of the Progressive Radio News Hour. His name is Stephen Lendman. He is a writer and broadcaster. His commentaries have appeared regularly on the website for the Center for Research on Globalization and on his blog, sjlendman.blogspot.com. Stephen has written on a number of topics related to national and international significance. In particular, he's written on and researched extensively the Middle East situation. It is my pleasure to welcome back Stephen Lendman to the Global Research News Hour. How are you, Stephen?
Oh, hi, Michael. It's good to be back on with you, and certainly an important topic to discuss.
Mm-hmm. Now, the last time we spoke, recent flare-up in violence had just begun as we were recording that interview. So I know that in the last week, there's been, you yourself have written at least 6 or 7 articles specifically dealing with this conflict. So I'd very much appreciate your input on this whole situation. For starters, the timing, it happened just a week after the U.S. elections, and is it just an interesting coincidence that it's happened when it has?
Oh, not at all. And by the way, since the conflict erupted on November 14th, I've literally written 2 articles every day on it, and I've got much of a new article for tomorrow sketched out, and I have a second article in mind, so I'll probably do 2 more today. The timing is always significant. I mean, this could have erupted much earlier. It could have been delayed until later. But on the one hand, you've got the U.S. elections. You've got Israeli elections coming up on the 22nd of January. That's a big issue. And, of course, Gaza remains under siege. It's been that way since June 2007, getting close to 5.5 years now. These are big issues. And I must say the so-called ceasefire has done very little to resolve what I think is most important. What's most important is getting Israel to agree with what it says it'll do, because it never does that, and it won't do it now. But the timing, again, I think that there were several reasons, or at least a couple, why Netanyahu and Washington together chose this time, Michael. This was a joint U.S.-Washington operation. I've got some information on that in the article.
Evidence for saying that it was that the U.S. was complicit in this operation?
Absolutely. Washington is complicit in all Israeli belligerence. You can go back as far as you want, at least to the 1960s. Let's use that as a timeline, the 1960s, the 67 war, so-called Six-Day War. Go back to that timeline. And all Israeli belligerence, larger, smaller scale, I mean, the small stuff, you know, Israel does that all the time. You know, they attack people, they kill Palestinians occasionally, they arrest a lot of people. Washington basically greenlights all of this to take place, but it's not directly involved. But when there's something significant that is planned, the last one before the current one was called Operation Cast Lead, that began on December 27th, 2008.
Also during an Israeli election, no?
Yeah, again, right ahead of an Israeli elections, when Ehud Olmert, the last prime minister, was running, and he was elected, and he got very strong support for that. I think one of Netanyahu's reasons is waging war against people you call terrorists is a good vote getter. At least it's worked that way in the past. Whether it works that way this time, well, we'll find out in January. But I think that's one of the reasons, ahead of the election, just the way Olmert did it in December 2008. So this one was November 14th, 2012, and it ended at 2 p.m. New York time, 9 p.m. Middle East time, Israeli and the Palestinian time, last night and yesterday afternoon in New York. That was one reason. Another reason was, and this I think is absolute fact, and I've mentioned this a number of times in previous articles, with respect to other incidents that have taken place. Israel spurns peace and stability. For Israel's imperial agenda to work, it needs violence and instability. It's the same for America's imperial agenda. Peace defeats them. So whenever it looks like peace may be erupt, you have to prevent it. The Palestinian leader in Gaza, Ahmed Jabari, he was the head of the Qassam Brigades, the defense force of Gaza, but he was also very involved in political negotiations. He had a great deal of political influence. He was an important figure, and behind the scenes, he was negotiating some kind of a cessation of hostilities or peace agreement, call it what you will, before Operation Pillar of Cloud, which is the eight-day operation that Israel just ended, that was the name of it, taken out of a passage in Exodus, using the Old Testament to justify killing and slaughter and destruction.
Now,
that's what they do, Michael, all the time. But Israel, he had negotiated an agreement. He had a draft agreement in hand to end the hostilities and begin some kind of a period of peace. He had that document in his hands. The Palestinians and Israelis had agreed to it. You know, the Israelis rhetorically, the Palestinians absolutely agreed to it. Jabari was murdered. Israel murdered him. And that was the operative thing that incited this conflict. But there were other incidents before that. There were multiple Israeli provocations, killing a 12-year-old boy. There were others. I mentioned a few of them in articles that I wrote. And Hamas did nothing until, I think they responded to a 12-year-old boy being killed. I think I get the exact timing of what happened after what incident. I'd have to go back and refer to old notes, mm-hmm. but I think it was after a 12-year-old boy was murdered, and there were other Israeli killings before that. The Hamas responded and fired a rocket at an Israeli jeep. It either damaged or destroyed the jeep, and it injured a few Israeli soldiers. And then Jabari's assassination took place. All of Gaza just erupted because of that, because he was a very well-respected figure. And that was a targeted assassination to prevent peace breaking out, Michael. That was what really got Operation Pillar of Cloud going. But Israel planned it that way. Israel planned Operation Pillar of Cloud jointly with Washington months in advance. I mean, think about this for a moment, Michael. Israel attacked over 8 days something on the order of 1,500 separate sites. Imagine the planning that goes into deciding what sites to target. It takes months of planning, plus all the other tactics, the overall strategy. And for weeks ahead of when this conflict began, Washington and Israel were holding joint military exercises. And they ended just around the time this conflict began.
How often do they have these joint military exercises?
As far as I'm sorry, repeat that.
Oh, I was wondering, if the United States and Israel, what is the frequency of these joint military exercises? Maybe once every couple of years, or more frequently? Do you know?
They don't happen too often. I'm not certain when the last one was held, but I do know this. The ones that were just completed that went on for several weeks or a month, they were the largest joint U.S.-Israeli military exercises ever held. There were thousands of forces involved. And part of what was practiced was intercepting incoming rockets. You know, Israel's Iron Dome, that is way overrated, by the way. Missile defense is more illusion than fact. Maybe they knock down some of them, but the great majority of incoming munitions land. So I can remember writing long ago, Michael.
Yeah, I don't necessarily want to divert the conversation, but this missile defense system, but what we're hearing through the press is that there were over 1,400 Gaza rockets aimed at Israel, either in provocation or in retaliation, depending on which side you want to listen to. And yet there were only 5 Israeli deaths. Not that those aren't significant, but the idea is that there were, that's a lot of firepower and relatively few deaths. And so one wonders to what extent that Iron Dome might have been being put to the test. Is there any aspect of that you could comment on?
I think the issue is not Iron Dome. The issue is the accuracy of these rockets. I have no idea how accurately Hamas or any other group can fire them. I do know this, when Jabari was still living and heading the defense force, the Qassam Brigades, occasionally when they would respond to Israeli attacks by firing their own rockets into southern Israel, I didn't know this until I began writing about this current operation, but Jabari literally targeted open spaces to avoid killing Israelis. Can you imagine that? Now, after an operation this big, maybe 170 Palestinians were killed that we know of, and the real death count is a lot higher than that because there are lots of people buried under rubble that haven't been found yet. So I'm sure the death toll is going to pass 200, and there were some people so seriously injured, they'll perish, they won't survive. And I wrote about a couple. But Jabari deliberately targeted open spaces. How accurate these rockets are going into a greater distance into Israel, I have no idea. But even Israel admitted that they knocked down about a third of the rockets, missiles, whatever you want to call them, coming in. So I doubt that if they said a third, my guess is at best they intercepted maybe half that number. And even that would be tough because missile defense is a long way from being perfected. So I think the issue is not Iron Dome.
Mm-hmm. Now, one more question about Ahmed Jabari. I mean, you mentioned him as being a highly respected figure and that he was assassinated by the Israelis. The negotiations he was involved with, I don't remember a lot of mainstream coverage of those peace negotiations. Do you?
Oh, there was no coverage at all. I mean, I knew nothing about them. I think this was all done very, very hush-hush. I didn't even know there was an agreement until after he was assassinated and Operation Pillar of Cloud began. And then I discovered that. I didn't know it. And I'm researching what's going on over there all the time. So I think this was kept very, very quiet. I follow the Israeli press all the time. I saw nothing written in the Israeli press discussing this at all. And there are a few good people. There's a lot of hardline commentary coming out of Israel, the way it is out of the West, Michael. But the one that I follow the most is Haaretz, and they have a couple of wonderful writers, Gideon Levy and Amira Haas, and they tell it the way it is. Not perfectly, not all the time, but Amira Haas once lived in Gaza, just to know what was going on there firsthand. It's been a good while since she's been there, but she did live there for a time. But I follow what they do and what they write about. I never saw anybody mention anything about negotiations going on. So I think it was kept very secretive. Mm.
So if this assassination took place as a way of preventing the peace, and now we've got a ceasefire, does that suggest that something else is in the works to kind of prevent a true peace from being established?
Well, let me put it this way to begin with, Michael. The terms agreed on were very, very similar to the terms that followed Cass Lead that ended in January 2009. It's almost a replica. I'm certain it isn't word for word, but it's a very similar kind of agreement following a conflict. We know what happened after Cass Lead. Conflict didn't end. Conflict continued. You know, it ebbs, it flows, it ebbs and flows. There are smaller, mostly smaller attacks, but I've written numerous times in the past few years how Israel will bomb Gaza for a day or for 2 days, or there'll be a small ground incursion, tanks will go in, heavy armor will go in, Palestinians will be killed, the border guards are shooting farmers in their fields, they're shooting kids to get too close to the border. This stuff never ends. It's not going to end now, Michael. So I say what needs to be said. The so-called ceasefire now is a ruse, and I quoted Netanyahu. He gave the game away. He said Israel will continue to do anything we have to protect the Israeli people. Well, that's code language, meaning, you know, we'll attack if we feel that we want to attack, and we'll manufacture a pretext. We'll say, well, they started it. They're the bad guys. Well, Israel said that this time. They only responded to Hamas rockets. That was a lie. That was a lie. There were multiple Israeli attacks before Hamas ever responded, and they did it in self-defense, and they got blamed for being the provocateur. Israel is the provocateur. Israel is always the provocateur, Michael. And again, Washington and Israel agree on this. So again, they blame the victim all the time. It's going to happen again. I know it's going to happen again. I just don't know when.
Now, one of the details that we've been treated to over the last week is this idea that the rockets have gone so much further than anticipated before, that the rockets from Gaza have reached Tel Aviv. Do you see Egypt post-Arab Spring as being a major player in this improved capacity on the part of Hamas to fight back?
I would say marginally. I think Morsi may be better than Mubarak in terms of Palestinian-Egyptian relations. But there's such important things. The military is the real power in Israel and in Egypt. The military is the real power. So I don't know how much influence Morsi really has. I mean, they may cut him a lot of slack, but, you know, I suspect there's a line that he knows he dare not cross. You know, Egypt has its own red line, and the military is the one that draws it. And I think they'll let him go so far, but no farther. But think about this. I mean, Washington supplies Israel with $1 billion to $2 billion in aid every single year. They want something back in return for that, and they get it. They
also supply Egypt, right?
So I think when push comes to shove, Egypt will not cross Israel or Washington beyond a certain amount of wiggle room that Morsi gets. And he can say anything he wants. You have to separate the rhetoric from the policy. So you get a lot of people that say the things that you really want to hear them say, but they don't back it up with the policies to enforce the comments they made. In other words, they're talking to their own people to make them think they're really doing something, where behind the scenes they're doing much less or all too often nothing at all. So again, I think Morsi may be an improvement for Palestinians. Not for Egyptian people so much, but for Palestinians as far as a better policy. I think there probably are decent relations between Hamas and Morsi. Morsi represents the Muslim Brotherhood. That's a story all by itself. We don't have time to go into. I've written about the Muslim Brotherhood, but Hamas was an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, and they came into existence in the 1980s. And Israel supported them at that time, by the way. That's when Arafat was on the outs with Israel, and Israel supported Hamas as an alternative to Arafat and Fatah. And now Fatah is the one that Israel supports. I mean, they play this game all the time, back and forth like a ping pong game. You know, today's enemy is tomorrow's ally, is the next day's enemy again. And America does the same thing with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is used both as enemy and ally, and sometimes at the same time.
Yes. Now, I wonder if there's a couple of media talking points I'd like you to address. You know, Israel has defended their actions, saying when forced to confront the civilian casualties, they say that the Hamas terrorists are using civilians as human shields. And so, of course, we've seen so many civilian casualties, including journalists. So I wonder if you could, you know, address that point that is being raised by the Israelis about, you know, they're concealing their rockets and the civilian infrastructure. And so, you know, they, in order to defend themselves, they have no choice.
Oh, that's a bald-faced lie. It's an absolute bald-faced lie. I have no idea where the rockets are stored, but they certainly don't store them in the basements of people's homes. I mean, that is absolutely crazy. As far as killing journalists, this is Israel's war on truth. I mean, they attacked regional ones, Hamas, an Al-Quds TV, Al-Quds meaning Jerusalem TV station, but they also damaged Al Jazeera's office. Al Jazeera has gotten to be so pro-Western at times, so I'm surprised they struck that building. But basically what Israel is trying to do in that case was silence truth. But Israel will manufacture lies, and the idea of calling Hamas a terrorist organization is absolutely false. The State Department only did that at the behest of Israel. Hamas is the democratically elected government of Palestine, all of Palestine. The Fatah government in the West Bank is a coup d'etat government. It has no legitimacy. And Mahmoud Abbas, the so-called president, who Israel made president by rigging his election, 2006, whenever it was, and his term expired in January 2009. He refuses to step down. I don't know when he's going to step down. He did nothing. He did nothing during this conflict to help the people of Gaza. A Palestinian leader, he's Israel's enforcer. He did nothing to help his own people. He's a disgrace. I don't know what he's going to do at the end of the month at the UN, where he's going to ask to upgrade Palestine status to non-member observer status. And whether he'll actually do that at the end of the month, we'll have to wait and see.
We also hear about how Hamas refuses to recognize Israel.
That's not true either. Hamas will recognize Israel if Israel will recognize Palestine as a legitimate state, which it is and has been since November 15th, 1988. Francis Boyle is the one who drew up their Declaration of Independence. It's now over 24 years in existence, and there are countries that recognize Palestine as a sovereign state. The UN membership business is a separate issue. It has nothing to do with statehood, just UN membership. But a sovereign state should be a full member, and Abbas could be a full member of the UN if he wanted to. It's simple. It's simple as pie. He could get it in a matter of weeks. It has nothing to do with the Security Council. It has everything to do with the General Assembly, Michael, and they absolutely would vote full membership rights for Palestine, but Abbas won't even go for that. He'll only go for non-member rights, which is a step up from what exists now, but he should have gone for the whole thing, and he should have done it long ago, but he doesn't do it because Israel doesn't want him to do it. That's why I'm skeptical about what he's doing now, but all of these things that Israel says, they're all bald-faced lies.
Now, in the time we've got left, I'm wondering if you could put this situation in a larger geopolitical context, you know, in terms of if the United States, as you say, is facilitating this operation Pillar of Cloud, what is the end game then? I mean, you put it in the context of Syria, Iran. What is your estimation of the overall strategy?
Oh, big important topic that you brought up, Michael. Absolutely crucial. Major geopolitical interests involved in this. Israel wants to be a regional hegemony. Israel wants all rival countries that threaten its hegemony, in other words, to be the unchallenged dominating country of the region, tiny Israel. Any country challenging its dominance, I don't mean militarily, I mean politically, they want them removed, and Israel's strategy is divide and conquer, balkanize these countries. Israel literally has a plan going back to the 1980s where all the countries in the region that might be a political challenge to Israel, Israel wants them balkanized, divided by ethnicities or Sunni Shia, whatever. Just divide them up into small pieces like Yugoslavia was in the 1990s, so they'll have no rivals. They'll have no regional rivals. America wants to be a global hegemon, but it certainly wants to be the boss in the Middle East. Israel is a junior partner in everything between these two countries. Washington calls the shots when it really comes down to it. But the rivals are being attacked and eliminated one way or another. I've said many times what's going on in Syria right now. That was planned in the 1990s, I'm convinced, and I think Paul Wolfowitz was the one who did it. It was just a matter of deciding what country will be attacked when. So, you know, we know what's gone on. I mean, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria is under attack now. So far, it's only by proxy forces. But this is Washington's war. against Syria. Israel would like another government, but I think Israel is very concerned about the possibility of a radical Islamist regime coming to power. Israel would like a change from the Abbas government, but it would like a moderate regime taking over. Israel doesn't care whether it's Islamist or not. We're just like a moderate people in charge. So Israel has a legitimate concern that they won't be moderate at all, and then maybe the next war they'll fight will be against Israel. Washington wants Abbas removed. All of these independent states, all of the states that have been attacked have been independent states, every single one of them. Washington wants them all replaced with pro-Western puppets. So that's the issue in all of them, Libya last year, Syria this year. And the road to Iran runs through Damascus. You get rid of Abbas and get a puppet regime in. They want to do the same thing in Lebanon, getting rid of Hezbollah, another independent regime. Hezbollah is part of the government. It is not a terrorist organization. It was elected by the Lebanese people. It's a shared government. They're part of a coalition, but they have a very dominant position there. And of course, Hamas, the legitimate government of Palestine. Well, Israel wants all of these regimes eliminated. I'm not certain Israel wants Hamas eliminated, because Hamas is a very useful punching bag. So I think it serves Israel's interest to have Hamas run Gaza so they can beat up on them every now and then and claim they're terrorists. Otherwise, if peace breaks out again, Israel is defeated. So Hamas is the way to keep peace from breaking out. But again, in Iran threatens nobody. Its nuclear program is entirely peaceful. Everybody knows that in high places, but nobody will admit it. The U.S. intelligence every year says the same thing. There's no evidence that Iran has a military program, a military nuclear program. Iran hasn't attacked another country in two or three centuries. No country in the region fears Iran, but you've got to stoke this fear. And again, the issue in Iran and all these countries that are independent is get rid of them, get pro-Western puppets in. Those are the big geopolitical issues.
So, Stephen Lendman, how do you see this grim scenario actually playing out? Are the U.S. and its partner Israel going to be successful in their goals?
Well, I think you have to separate short-term from longer-term. Even short-term, it hasn't been very successful, Michael. The last war America won was World War II. I would say all those other wars didn't particularly turn out so well. The only thing America excels at is mass slaughter and destruction, and they've certainly succeeded at that. North Korea in the 1950s, I mean, they literally ran out of targets. They turned the whole country into rubble, and large parts of Afghanistan, the same thing, turned the place into rubble. But, of course, the fighting forces remained, and I sure hope that they're not thinking about another war with North Korea. I don't think the South wants any part of that. They should have something to say about it. But the wars have not been successful. You know, it just kind of damping down things and kicking the can down the road and maintaining U.S. hegemony. I remember on my own program and the latest book by Gabriel Kolko at the time, a historian and expert on the Vietnam War, he believes that America's decline began during the Korean War. And another man I had once on my program, Emanuel Wallerstein, also a good thinker, he thinks America's decline began during the Vietnam War. These conflicts maybe prolong America's dominance, but the more of this stuff that goes on, Michael, the faster America's decline accelerates. And there are other people who feel the same thing. Chalmers Johnson, I wish he was still living. He's been gone a couple of years now. I had him on my program once. I wrote about one of his books, but he believed that. I mean, you perpetuate this cycle of violence, one war after another war after another war. They never end. And this is literally sowing the seeds of your own destruction. And all empires in the past that overreached, as Chalmers would say, they all ended up the same way. They self-destroyed, self-destructed. They destroyed themselves. This is the path Israel is on. This is the path America is on. When it'll happen, I don't know, but it will happen, Michael. And my only fear is because of the power of the weapons that exist today, when America goes down or Israel goes down or they both go down, they just may end up taking humanity with them.
Well, Stephen Lendman,
grim thought.
On that rather grim note, but you know, we'll be hopeful that things do help, basically, that we do see a peace in the region finally and once and for all, a just peace. So thank you, Stephen Lenman, once again for your insightful thoughts about the subject.
Well, thank you, Michael. Again,
you can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering stations across the country. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Technical assistance for this installment of the Global Research NewsHour was provided by Pearl Timchuk. I am series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.